Om Jnanadhimadannasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Dhena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha.
So we're so lucky tonight that we have with us the Bhagavad Gita. In fact, it looks like we're surrounded by Bhagavad Gitas. And our intention is to surround the whole Bay Area with Bhagavad Gitas so nobody can get out. We're doing our best to inundate. When Yogeshwara Prabhu, one of the early translators of Srila Prabhupada's books into French, had finished one of his publications, he brought it to Srila Prabhupada. He felt a little timid to go in. There were some of the senior devotees with Prabhupada and managers and so forth, and Yogeshwara Prabhu, who's a great scholar and who's also is bilingual, went in with this new publication in French and showed it to Srila Prabhupada. And Prabhupada looked at the book and he said, inundate. So this is the mood of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. He and his followers caused an inundation of love for God. And by going out and tasting the chanting of Hare Krishna for themselves and doing it in public places and then going door to door, they were able to influence everybody to chant Hare Krishna. And that same mood of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and the same teachings have been passed down through the parampara, which means one after another, there are great souls who step up, who take on the same mood and the same teachings. They study them carefully, they apply them to their own lives, they realize it, and they pass it on to their students. And in this way, through many, many generations coming from Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, there are thousands and millions of devotees who have taken up the process of bhakti as explained by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself, who, if one reads the Chaitanya Charitamrita, one will discover is none other than Krishna himself, who has appeared in the age of Kali in order to distribute a love for God. The Chaitanya Charitamrita begins with the statement, Anarpita charim chirat karuna yavatirna kalau samarpayitum unuto jvalarasam sopakti shriyam. There's a way in which Krishna considers, after coming and teaching the Bhagavad Gita, that for a long time I have not brought the very specific information about my most intimate pastimes in the spiritual world. And therefore, I'll go there and I'll set the example and I'll show everyone the process by which they can attain to the highest goal of life, which is spontaneous loving service to God. So Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and associates didn't care for any boundaries. They didn't care where was a good place or a bad place to distribute Krishna consciousness. They considered every place open, as do the devotees here at ISKCON Silicon Valley. They go here, there, and everywhere, and consider, they hold the perspective as given to us in the Sri Ishapanishad, Isavasya midam sarvam yat kincha jagatyam jagat, tena tyaktena bunjita magridha kasasuddhanam. Everything animate or inanimate within the universe is controlled and owned by the Lord. One should therefore accept only those things necessary for himself, which are set aside as his quota. One should not accept other things, knowing well to whom they belong. So the devotees consider that everything belongs to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and they even consider that the way in which these cities and towns and apartment complexes are set up is the direct arrangement of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu to give us more access to the people in the age of Kali Yuga, because we can go door to door very easily there. It's only a few steps between each door. And we thank the Lord for setting this up for us so that we can do door to door very proficiently. And sometimes when the devotees are out in the city, a place where even the authorities aren't quite clear who owns what and what all the ordinances are, the devotees take the direct order of the Supreme Personality of Godhead to go here, there, and everywhere and distribute Krishna consciousness. Some of our devotees, for instance, Govinda Madhava Prabhu goes downtown It's a confusing place. Sometimes you'll park your car there and it'll get towed away. And you wonder why, because the signs are ambiguous. And the laws are ambiguous too. Policemen don't really know what's going on down there. They just make stuff up as they go along. So our Govinda Madhava doesn't take no for an answer. Sometimes they come up to his book table and they'll say, oh, you can't do that here. And he'll produce a permit that we have from the state, city of San Francisco. And he'll say, I'm sorry, but we do, and show that. And then if one of them says, and they have, oh, that permit doesn't apply here, he'll say, oh, no, we just talked to our lawyer. He said it's fine. And then they go away. So devotees are very convinced about the fact that the entire world is meant for spreading Krishna consciousness. They take Krishna's words seriously, and actually this is what it means to be a devotee. It means to take Krishna's words in the Bhagavad Gita seriously. If one takes Krishna's words in the Bhagavad Gita to be meant for oneself, and thinks that just by following these I'll attain the perfection of life, one is considered to be a devotee. One of my mentors early on in Krishna consciousness, Kritakarma, the first one I met when I walked into the San Francisco temple, in fact, I didn't even get in the temple, he was outside hosing down the alleyway, which we stored a lot of the vegetable boxes and things like that, needed to be cleaned regularly, keep the temple grounds clean. And as I was coming in, he asked me if I wanted to help, so he handed me the hose, and I was hosing things down. And he used to take me around to a few places in the city. I'd go with him to buy vegetables and also then on Sankirtan. And people sometimes would ask, well, who are you people? Because we didn't look like others. In the 1970s, people were growing their hair long and we were taking all our hair off. And he would say something very sweet. He'd say, oh, we're devotees of Lord Krishna. And I thought, that's so nice. I'm glad to be here with Kritakarma and be counted among the devotees of Lord Krishna. And if one simply becomes a devotee of Lord Krishna, then one's life will be happy. This is Krishna's advice in the Bhagavad Gita. It's so simple. He says, man mana bhava mad bhakto madhyaji mam namaskuru mami vaishyasi satyam te pratijani priyosime. Basically, he's saying a few simple things, which is, think of me and become my devotee and offer obeisances unto me and worship me. These are simple things that are very natural. And he tells the ways in which that one can do that. For instance, he says, patram pushpam palam toyam yomi bhaktya priyachati taraham bhakti paritam ashnami paritatmana. He goes as far as to say, if you just offer me with love and devotion, which means from the perspective that I'm a devotee of Lord Krishna, and therefore I offer everything to him, a leaf, a flower, fruit, or water, then Krishna says, I'll take it. I'll eat that from my devotee. He is offering with love because he's my devotee. So that's a simple thing. And manmana, thinking of Krishna and bowing down to him and then becoming his devotee. So one of the main ways to become Krishna's devotee is to become a devotee of the Bhagavad Gita. Because the Bhagavad Gita is Krishna's main book. There are many books in the world, but if one focuses on the Bhagavad Gita and learns the Bhagavad Gita by reading it every day, reading at least 20 verses, you can survive on that. Less than that, you'll become anemic spiritually if you don't read at least 20 verses a day. Then you hear the Bhagavad Gita, you hear Krishna's instructions, and you think, I'm a devotee of Krishna, I'll listen to what he has to say and I'll follow it. And then your life will feel, I have purpose, I have a goal. And this helps to overcome all the anxieties of life. Because there are many expectations that people may have of us that are unreasonable and are not really helpful. But the expectations that Krishna has for us are reasonable, and they bring the greatest result. One of the great secret teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, and Krishna says it's all teaching, all secret. He says, Raja Vidya Raja Kuhyam. This is secret because most people are so distracted that they can't take even 10 minutes to sit down and read the Bhagavad Gita. That's why it's so secret. Even though it's sitting right there. Even throughout India, Bhagavad Gita is everywhere. But if you ask somebody, what is Bhagavad Gita? And they'll say, oh, I love Bhagavad Gita. What is it? And they'll say something very simple, like to indicate, I haven't read Bhagavad Gita. But if one investigates a little bit, just 10 minutes a day, what Krishna has to say in Bhagavad Gita and thinks, I'm a devotee of Krishna, then one will find some secrets. And one of the great secrets that Krishna gives at the end of the Bhagavad Gita is that if you take it as your cause to teach Bhagavad Gita to others, to make sure that other people get a chance to read Bhagavad Gita, then Krishna says, there's nobody in this world that I like better. That's good information to have. How to get close to Krishna? Be a fan of the Bhagavad Gita. It's his book. He spoke it. And then go out and teach it to others. Teach it to whom? Anybody. Just go out and find places where people would like to hear about how to solve the problems of life. And they're all over the place. Everyone's trying to do that in their own way. And if you offer the simple solutions that come from the Bhagavad Gita, along with a copy of the Bhagavad Gita so they can take it home and read it, then you're doing work that Krishna says is the most dear to him, that makes you the most dear to him. So one of the services that we offer at ISV, ISKCON of Silicon Valley, in fact all over the International Society for Krishna Consciousness, following the direction and in the footsteps of our founder Acharya, Srila Prabhupada, is to make Bhagavad Gita available to the whole world in as many places as possible. We see from time to time now that people are checking into hotels and motels in various places around the world and opening the drawer, and then they're shocked to see that there's a copy of the Bhagavad Gita sitting within the drawer. And this doesn't happen by accident. This is a deliberate attempt to inundate the world with the Bhagavad Gita. In fact, I was there when it started. A devotee came up to me. Well, I remember I was sitting chanting japa back in the old temple, and a devotee named Mayapur Bihari came up to me, and he said, excuse me, I think I have something really urgent to tell you. Sorry to interrupt your japa. I said, okay, go ahead. And he said, I have an idea to put Bhagavad Gitas in every hotel and motel in America. And I said, fantastic idea, go for it. And he immediately jumped up. I could see he was getting on the phone, he was doing it. And next thing we know, we were on television. And the people at the news station thought this was some amazing thing, that the Bhagavad Gita was going into all the hotels and motels. And now, hundreds and thousands of books later, we're finding that people are seeing the Bhagavad Gita here, there, and everywhere in their motels. It's becoming famous. So this is kirtan, this is sankirtan. To expand the teachings of Krishna, to expand his fame all over the world. And the Bhagavad Gita is a good way to do that, because people appreciate books. When they find a Bhagavad Gita, they'll pick it up, they'll look through it, and they'll find extraordinary knowledge that they won't find anywhere else. This is actually the greatest mission that one could embark upon in one's life. Even if you moonlight, even if you just do it a little bit at a time, and you connect yourself to this kind of work of expanding the Bhagavad Gita all over the world, you'll find that you'll have an extra impetus in life that you didn't have before. This is different from making advancement in any other kind of endeavor or any other kind of discipline to make Krishna's words available to people of the world. It has an impact greater than any other kind of work that one could do to help people, I would argue. And this is the theme of this whole month we have here in December at ISKCON of Silicon Valley, and that is to expand the reach of Bhagavad Gita all over the Bay Area. And institutions, we're putting motels, hotels, hospitals. In fact, all over North America, the Bhagavad Gitas are going out by the tens of thousands. This month alone, our goal is to distribute 20,000 Bhagavad Gitas just during this 1 month of December. And I want you to picture in your mind's eye, just for a moment, what happens when one person gets a copy of the Bhagavad Gita. and puts it in his or her home. Are you imagining that? What do you see? What are you seeing?
Get busy.
Get busy? But what specifically kind of, what things do you see happening when somebody gets a Bhagavad Gita in their home? Yes. Did we get the microphone? Or did we trade him in for Bhagavad Gitas? I guess we don't have them anymore. We used to have microphones. It was a different era.
Most probably the person will think that I paid for it, so let me at least, you know, read few pages. So he will, that way he'll come in contact with some few...
Which pages words. Do you think that he'll open to?
Pictures, maybe.
Open the picture. What picture will this person see? Is it a man or a woman who is opening the book? Why don't you be specific?
I have to speculate now.
Okay, go ahead. Just its imagination.
Most probably woman.
Okay, it's a woman, and now she's opening the book. Which picture does she see now?
So, you know, the soul is passing through all the different...
She opens to the changing bodies. She changing sees the soul bodies. Passing from one body to the next.
Yeah.
What's her reaction?
Reaction is there is something permanent in this changing world. Basically, that the same soul which is still permanent, that spark is permanent.
Is that a kind of picture she'd see anywhere else, like in the New York Times crossword section?
I don't think so.
On a billboard driving on the 101 freeway, anything like that?
No.
So this is all new?
Yes, this is new, yeah.
It's a revelation?
Yeah.
Okay, that's powerful. A powerful image to think of one soul coming in contact with one Bhagavad Gita, and then think of 20,000 Bhagavad Gitas. What kind of damage does that do to the materialistic society? And one of the great impetus of the Krishna consciousness movement really is to re-spiritualize society, give people a new way of looking at life so that they can rise above that which Prahlad Maharaj says is recycling everything. It's punak punas chavita charvananam. Everyone's getting the same kind of stuff over and over again, just recycled. And they're not getting any flavor out of it. It's like when you put sugarcane through the grinder. And then they do it twice because they're very thrifty and they like to get every drop. It goes through and it's completely dry. And then I see they throw it in a pile and there's cows and monkeys over there like trying to get even just one drop out of it. And there's kind of an aroma that there should be something sweet, there should be juice, but no juice. So chewing that which has already been chewed is the activity of the material world, but when one gets the Bhagavad Gita, one actually gets real juice. A whole reservoir of juice. In fact, people sometimes sit down and start to read the Bhagavad Gita, and they realize, oh, I've discovered a reservoir of juice. I can drink from here again and again, and they do. They read it again and again, and the more they read it, the deeper their experience is, and then they become devotees of Lord Krishna, because Krishna directly speaks to them through the Bhagavad Gita and gives them direction. Krishna Maheshwari Prabhu had his hand up in the back.
Hare Krishna. So I was also imagining that a man would open up that book and show the picture of the transmigration of the soul to his wife. And his wife would be wondering at first, does the soul only transmigrate for men? And then they would go and have a discussion and get deeper into the Gita as a result.
Yes, and it's shocking too when people see it for the first time. I was in Montreal, Canada, and we were at a Ratha Yatra, and we had set up entire festival area, and I had a book booth right near the Changing Bodies exhibit. So this was a day before the Ratha Yatra, and there were a few people walking around here and there, and a Canadian couple, locals, had strolled across the grounds, not intending to come across anything transcendental, in fact, probably hoping to avoid such things, and they came upon the Changing Bodies exhibit, hand in hand, and from my vantage point, I could watch their expressions and hear what they were saying, and so they looked at it for some time, and their countenances changed as they observed what was actually going on there. And the man said to his wife, "Let's get out of here." And he kind of pulled her, you know, in a way that they sort of made an escape, because they had seen something that was so otherworldly and so directly confronting to their sense of reality that it was a stark realization I could see for them. So oftentimes, when we distribute these books, we don't think about the impact, but the impact's always there. When the books go out, they remain, and sometimes they patiently wait on people's shelves for 20, 30 years until somebody needs it, and they'll pull it down off the shelf, and they'll begin reading it, and Krishna again speaks to them in his eternal voice. Who else had a vision of where the book goes? Yes, Radha Kripa Prabhu.
Maharaj, just to continue what Prabhu was mentioning, I would just imagining that after you look at the changing body, and then you get a little scared, or something is going to happen, I'm going to grow old, and then will die, and then I'll try to see, then I'll read the footprint, you know, what is the message there, then there's a shloka reference to that one, then I really wanted to go where, you know, from where this information come from. So open that shloka, then I'll be like wondering, now, wait a minute, who wrote this one? Then get deeper into that. So,
yeah, when a book goes out into society, has its impact, and when people read it and appreciate it, they may come to the point of asking this question, where did this come from? Who organized this? And they'll want to go more deeply within it. Anyone else? Yes, Advait. Advait has a lot of experience on Sankirtan. He's been going out door to door since he was in a baby carriage. Right? Even before the baby carriage, as Kameshri pointed out in one of her seminars, somebody asked, at what age do the children start distributing books here? And she said, the baby carriage. She said, actually, even before that. Go ahead, Advait.
So my vision was that so someone would flip open to the pictures, and they would open to that yogi page where there's like a streak going to the moon, and they'd think, who is this guy? And at the reference, they'd go to the page sloka, and they'd read the translation and say, so this is who this is. And they'd learn about all the different types of shudras, vaishyas. And in this way, they'd know more about the Bhagavad Gita.
Yeah, it's a compelling picture, isn't it? Well, the first time I saw in the Bhakti Godhead magazine, the advertisement for Easy Journey to Other Planets. I was in high school at the time, and I thought that was a great idea. But people don't get offered opportunities to go to other planets, especially with an easy journey. So these are unique literatures, and there are ways to keep oneself occupied in this life, working and so forth, which is necessary to keep the body and soul together. But if one takes up the great activity of distributing Bhagavad Gita, then one will become well known, and one, even more importantly, will become known by Krishna. As he says, there's no one in this world more dear to me than the person who takes up the cause of teaching the Bhagavad Gita to others. So we can distribute the Bhagavad Gita, and we can read it. And here's a list, a Chad report for Kartik 2017. These are dedicated devotees of the Bhagavad Gita all over the world. And for Kartik 2017, here's a performance summary. The number of devotees who registered on the website was 388. I mean, that takes some enthusiasm to actually open the computer, get on the website, and say, I'm going to register for this. They're thinking, let me read the Bhagavad Gita. And then the number of devotees in the Chad Yahoo group, that's ongoing members, is 281. 281 devotees. And the total devotees who reported their scores from Kartik was 87. So 61.9% are those who recited Chad every day. 25% missed a day or two. And 13.1% said, I recited a few times. So all of them are great souls. And then we have a list here of the Kartik Chad champions. That is, those who think that it's a good idea to read Bhagavad Gita every day. And the list goes on and on. I mean, look at these names of devotees from all over the world that connected to Chad. And these are just the ones that came onto the website and reported that they did it. There are others that are doing it. And in one sense, it's a big number. In another sense, compared to the world population, or even the population of this particular county that we're in, it's relatively small. So we would like to increase the number of people reading Bhagavad Gita, appreciating Bhagavad Gita, because our theory is that when people take in the vibration of the Bhagavad Gita, their lives will become more productive. They'll become happier. They'll become free from anxiety. Let me give you some evidence from the Bhagavad Gita about how this happens. So in the Bhagavad Gita 6.20 through 23, this is a combination of three verses in which Lord Krishna is describing the happiness that one gets from unburdening oneself from material association. Material association is described in the Srimad Bhagavatam to be like a person who's carrying around a heavy weight and doesn't have any place to put it down. And then shifts the weight from carrying it in his hands and then he put it on his shoulder. Does that make it better? For a couple seconds. And then after the shoulder gets tired, he transfers it to his head. Does that make it better? Just for a couple seconds. And then back to the shoulder, back to the hands, never being able to put the weight down. This is the way in which one becomes burdened by material life. And there's a state of life called nirvana, through which one gives up the burden of the material world. It's a great relief. So this chapter is about yoga. This sixth chapter of the Bhagavad Gita is about yoga. And Prabhupada quotes in his purports in this chapter from Patanjali, who described the Ashtanga yoga process, through which one can unburden oneself by calming the mind and seeing past the mind and connecting oneself to the internal energy of the Lord and seeing oneself as part of that internal energy of the Lord. And when one witnesses that and sees that I have nothing at all to do with the material world, it's actually a virtual reality that's running on the screen of my mind. This is a kind of software, the mind, that we need to interact, to connect our physical senses with the objects of the world. But it's only imaginary. And there's a way in which we burden ourselves by that misidentification, thinking that I'm part of this world and the things that are happening to me in this dreamlike state in the material world, virtual reality-like state, are actually a consequential. But ultimately, they're not, because we don't have anything to do with the material world. Asango hyayam purusha means that the soul has nothing at all to do with the material world. So here's the experience that a yogi has who is able to achieve this state of nirvana from the practice of yoga. In the stage of perfection called trance or samadhi, one's mind is completely restrained from material mental activities by practice of yoga. This perfection is characterized by one's ability to see the self by the pure mind and to relish and rejoice in the self. In that joyous state, one is situated in boundless transcendental happiness, realized through transcendental senses, established thus, one never departs from the truth, and upon gaining this, he thinks there is no greater gain. Being situated in such a position, one is never shaken, even in the midst of greatest difficulty. This indeed is actual freedom from all miseries arising from material contact. This is only the preliminary stage that of happiness that one achieves by the practice of yoga. And another example given about our plight in the material world is that of being chased by a sinister person. You have to run away and try to find a place to hide. So imagine you're being chased by someone with ill intent, and you run and you're looking for places to hide, and finally you find a broom closet. You go inside and close the door. And then for a while you're safe because you've locked yourself in the broom closet. And then the pursuer may give up and go away for some time, but still you have to come back out again. Still you'll be chased when you get back out. The person's still out there lurking. Another example. You're in your home. It's a nice, sunny winter day here in California. And the door is slightly open to take in the nice, fresh air outside. And then a big cobra slithers through your door and goes behind the couch. And what do you do then? It's fine, just leave him. Once you know he's there, there'll be great anxiety. So there are all kinds of ways in which I carry my anxieties with me throughout my life, because as Prabhupada writes in his introduction to the Bhagavad Gita, I'm being stalked. I'm being stalked. And what is the ultimate stalker? He says, it's the tigress of death. Be around any corner for me. The idea that I'll cease to exist, that I'll have to give back everything that I've collected, that I'm holding on to very tightly. And this causes intense anxiety. And there is no relief in the material world. There's no solution, that is, that can take away that anxiety. It's simply like transferring the heavy box from one shoulder to the next, to the head, back to the hands. It just moves around until one actually deals with the root of the problem. And that is to understand, what is my transcendental, eternal nature? So, in describing this ultimate state of happiness, or the foundation of that happiness, Krishna gives us the verse 14:27. In this chapter of Bhagavad Gita, number 14, Krishna declares to be extremely important knowledge, in which he tells about how one gets wound up by the ropes of the material nature called the gunas, and they bind us in various ways and keep us tightly within the material world. So in this 27th verse of the 14th chapter, Krishna says, I am the basis of the impersonal Brahman, which is immortal, imperishable, and eternal, and it's the constitutional position of ultimate happiness. So when you are looking to embark upon a project, you want to know what's the foundation of the project. For instance, if you're going to bake bread or something like that, you want to know what's the main ingredient. And the main ingredient of happiness is Krishna. And he's declaring that right here, that I'm the foundational point of all happiness in this world. And so what are the characteristics of that happiness? He describes four characteristics of the foundation of happiness. So the first he describes is immortality. Who here would like to be immortal? 1, 2, 3 people. 4, 5, 6. A couple more. Everyone else is pretty happy with the prospect of fact, Socrates talked about the way in which those who live in the material world content themselves with what they already have. And he describes cave dwellers who are facing the back of the cave, and all they see is the shadows on the back wall. And they take that to be reality. And if somebody comes in and tries to tell them that there's another big world out there, and there's a sun, and there's more than just darkness, they may even become violently angry because they're accustomed to this and they don't like to be disturbed. So the idea that one could become immortal or deathless is practically beyond the reach of the mind. In fact, people simply accept it. They become conditioned to the idea that I'm the material body and that I have to die. And that's just the way it is. And an intelligent person, says the Vedas, is one who questions that norm and says, that doesn't seem normal to me. I'm not going to accept it. I'm going to try to see if there's something better than that. That's actually true intelligence, to question this idea that I have to die. So Krishna says, I'm the source of immortality. By being connected to Krishna as Krishna's devotee, being close to Krishna, one develops this characteristic of immortality. Actually, it's not something we develop, it's something we already are, but we've forgotten, and we've become covered over, and our conception of life has become muddied, and I think that I'm this material body, and therefore, the Srimad Bhagavatam says, Bhayam dvitya binibeshatasyad, fear arises. My whole existence is covered by fear. I was taking a walk this morning through the park. A beautiful morning. There was practically nobody there. And as I was walking home, I saw on the lawn of one of the neighborhood residents, there was a little dandelion flower. And there was a tiny little bird there, and he was feasting on the seeds from that dandelion. And he was about halfway finished with eating, and I was appreciating as I was walking by how delicate the flower was, how delicate the little bird was. And I'm a big human, and as I was walking down the sidewalk and I came fairly close to him, he looked over and he jumped away. And as he did, I was thinking, I had no intention of hurting him, but everybody in the material world is jumpy. Little birds are jumpy. Everybody's jumping. Everyone's looking over their shoulder thinking somebody's going to devour me or take my stuff. That's not happiness. And Krishna reveals to us in the Bhagavad Gita, in the second chapter, he doesn't wait very long to reveal to Arjuna how to solve the problem of life, which Arjuna is going through in a very acute way. He says, you're not going to die. You don't die. You're only passing through in this body. It's like yesterday, Advait was telling so many people when we were going door to door to show the Bhagavatam. He was explaining in the Bhagavad Gita how these bodies are just like clothes, and when they wear out, we just change them. And people sit up and listen to that, especially when a young person brings spiritual knowledge. Prabhupada mentions this in the Krishna book, because Krishna came out and he told Nanda Maharaj and all the residents of Vrindavan not to hold the Indra Yajna, and then he started spouting all kinds of philosophy, a lot of it bogus too. But he was bewildering their minds, but all of them were like, come over here, this little kid's talking philosophy. And they're all listening to him. So when you hear the philosophy of Bhagavad Gita, it immediately gives you foundation. And that's what Krishna is saying in this chapter. This is the foundation of happiness, to understand that you're immortal. And how to become immortal? Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, janma karma cha me divyam evam yoviti tatvata tyakva deham punar janma naiti mameti sojana. He said you have to learn something in this life. And learning is possible because humans are smart. They can learn stuff. They learn all kinds of stuff. But none of it in the university systems, in fact deliberately, gives people knowledge about the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who's the ultimate foundation of happiness. And so in this verse, Krishna says, if you just understand my nature as being transcendental, I take birth in this world, and I leave the world, and I work in this world, but I'm not touched by the world at all. I'm completely aloof from the modes of material nature because Krishna is the source of it all. and he's the controller of it all. And if you just understand that tattva, that truth about Krishna, then you also can attain a transcendental position. You don't have to take birth again in the material world. So immortality, that's important, don't you think? On a scale of 1 to 10, how important do you think immortality is? It's definitely a 10. Okay. Then he says, there's another point he says about the foundation of happiness. Imperishability. You don't perish. Do you have any perishables at home? Do you have to preserve them? Any other perishables you can think of? Huh? What part of the body? The face, the arms, everything's perishable. So it just wears out. That's why there's a cosmetic industry that sells billions of dollars worth of creams and all. It's basically all the same stuff, but they'll repackage it and say. And then we get some very attractive human being to, you know, put some on and it's like. And everyone wants this imperishability. This is the foundation of happiness. We know that in Palo Alto there's a store that we still haven't opened the packet they gave us, obviously, but it tells infinite beauty. It's right in a little packet, which means imperishability. I don't want to perish, and I don't want things to wear out. I hate it when they wear out. It's a constant source of anxiety, and this is mentioned by Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita. He says the realm you're living in wears out all the time. It's constantly wearing out. Bhutva, bhutva, praliyate. Constantly it's being destroyed. It's wearing out, and you can never catch up to that as a soul who's imperishable. But the foundation of happiness that Krishna teaches in the Bhagavad Gita is to come to understand my imperishable nature. And if one actually can see and experience one's real self as imperishable, then the great anxiety that I'm losing my stature in the world and my beauty and everything else, this becomes nullified. And this is a great burden lifted from the soul. Then he lists the next out of four. This is the third out of four, which are foundational to happiness in this world, and of which Krishna is the very source, eternality. Try to wrap your mind around that for a minute, eternality. What does it mean? It means you've always existed, and you always will exist. There's never a time that you have not existed, and there's never a time that you will not exist in the future. And you're co-eternal with Krishna. So this takes away the great anxiety that I will cease to be. In fact, there are many psychologists that write books. There's one called Denial of Death. And in this book, the author makes a very strong case that everything humans do in society and privately is to distract themselves from the prospect of death coming and taking everything away. After all, what is cricket for? It's a bunch of grown men, sorry everybody, you may hate me after this, but it's a bunch of grown men. Where did they get a cricket bat? They just invented that. They made that up. Some guy was sitting there and found some piece of wood in the field, said, just smooth that out a little bit, Deepak, you know, and he's like grinding it down a little bit. Actually, it's an English sport. But then, you know, like, okay, get that little fruit over there, chuck it at me, you know, boom, and I go, hey, you hit it. And then they started making up rules, and then they came up with the league, and then they came up with uniforms and names, and then everyone else is keeping score, and then it becomes a big deal. It's not a big deal. It's actually ludicrous. But it's a distraction nonetheless, and it's a way in, it's the way of the material world. Everyone has a way of ignoring their eternality. And the way they do that is by procrastinating. Instead of looking into the matter, instead of finding what is the foundation, what is the fountainhead of eternality, which is altogether possible. The Vedas are screaming it, saying, now's the chance. Atato Brahma Jignasa, now you have a chance. Ask about this question. Just ask. That's all you have to do. And you'll be informed. And people are like, no thanks. I didn't even want to ask the question. I'd rather distract myself unlimitedly through one inane activity after another in the material world, some of which are touted as being highly important. They're not. Asangokhyayam purusha, you have nothing to do with the material world. It's not your home, it's not your place, and it really doesn't matter what happens ultimately because you're not part of this world. It's a dream. So eternality is an aspect of our life. It is what we are, actually. And if we're able to embrace that, and we can, by connecting ourselves to the Supreme Eternal, the source of all eternals, nityo nityanam, chaitanas chaitananam. The Vedas say there's one Supreme Eternal who's the source of the plural eternals in the world. And there are there is a plurality of eternals, according to the Vedas. It's not that there's a homogeneous oneness with the Supreme, that we're all the Supreme, but we are part of the Supreme. And we're co-eternals with the Supreme, who's our source and our maintainer, according to Bhagavad Gita. This is Bhagavad Gita as it is. It gives clear, commonsensical knowledge. And when we understand that we are eternal along with Krishna, then we might then find out very readily what is our eternal occupation. And by engaging in that devotional service, we become happy. So that's three. And number four, are you ready for number four? Can you handle it? He says that this, he, Krishna, is the source of all happiness. All happiness comes from knowing Krishna, for living in Krishna, from serving Krishna. So again, the translation is, I am the source of all spiritual... Oh, that's a different verse. Here we go. He writes in 14:27, and I am the basis of the impersonal Brahman, which is immortal, imperishable, and eternal, and is the constitutional position of ultimate happiness. So, what is the constitutional position of ultimate happiness? It is Krishna. And there are ways in which one can connect with Krishna. But a little more evidence about the happiness of Krishna. First of all, there are various aspects of God. One is called Brahman. And that is the all-pervading effulgence of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And then there's the Paramatma, the way in which Krishna expands himself into every particle in the universe, and that includes the living entities. He's present there with everyone. And then there is Bhagavan, or the Supreme Personality of Godhead, who is the source of the two aforementioned energies, or manifestations of Krishna. And about Bhagavan, specifically, the personality of Godhead, and this is a concept that some people, because of trying to discover God through their intellect, which is takes one only to the position, as can take one only to the position of the impersonal aspect of God. One can't conceive of the Supreme Personality of Godhead unless one gets association with pure devotees who understand the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But that Bhagavan, that personality of Godhead, who's mentioned in the Upanishads, yesterday when we were in one of the homes, we were quoting verses from the Shriya Upanishad, and the Shriya Upanishad says, Hiranmayena Patrena Satyasyapitam Mukham. So this is a prayer that's given in the Shriya Upanishad, in which the devotee is saying, please remove the effulgence so that I can see your beautiful face and your form of bliss. So this is what the target and the goal of bhakti is, to see the face of the Lord, to engage in a relationship with him. And about that personal feature of the Lord, the Vedas say, raso vai saha, he is the reservoir of all happy relationships. And that's what everybody's looking for, but nobody's getting. Everybody's missing the mark until they find the ultimate source of happiness and who's behind it. And that's Krishna, who's the source of rasa and that is loving relationships. The kind of loving relationships that we seek in the material world, we get for some time, and then inevitably we lose them. They slip through our fingers. I was just talking to Nirukula today and examining how my parents, they died 1 year after the next, and one passed away, and then the next passed away. And then we were just seeing how the whole family is dispersing. My elder sister left her body, and then my niece is gone, and things dissipate. Everything falls apart. The relationship, the relationships that Srila Prabhupada had as a young man, he described later in life when he was sitting in Vrindavan before coming to the United States. He said, where are all my loving relatives? He said, now they are all just a list of names. They're compared to travelers. In fact, this was Hiranyakashipu, who was actually a devotee, but he came to play the part of a demon for a while. But he told his family members after the death of Hiranyaka, his brother, and everyone was distraught. So he said, look it, we're all just like travelers. We stop in an inn for a cold sarsaparilla drink, and then we enjoy a little sarsaparilla, and then we talk amongst ourselves, we become a little friendly, and then we get up, get in our separate vehicles, and go away, and we never see each other again. He said, similarly, we come together in family units, and we say, rah, rah, this is my family. We have an emblem on the front of the house. If you're rich, you say that, you know, this is our abode, this is our family tree, and all washed away within a moment. Everyone just departs and goes different directions. And the man in his next life becomes a woman. The woman in his next life becomes a man. Some people who are in their prime and they're thinking life's so good, and next life they become a kangaroo. And everyone's thinking this life is all the all in all. But this is nonsense. It's actually nonsense. It's an insanity. And so Krishna consciousness means reality and understanding that the source of all reality is, and the foundation of all is Bhagavan, Krishna, the personality of Godhead. So when one comes close to that personality of Godhead, then just by getting close, then this is the secret of bhakti. It may sound difficult to practice yoga or to keep up one's vows and so forth, but all you have to do is stay close to Krishna. Because, as Prabhupada writes in his purport to this verse that we're examining right now, he says, when a devotee approaches Krishna, there is an exchange of the six opulences. So Krishna has all the opulences. And when you just get close to him, then you start to take on all the opulences too. So the way in which to do that was taught by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And that is just by repeating his names. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. There Krishna is dancing on your tongue. So this is all just a tiny grain of sand, transcendental sand from the Bhagavad Gita. But there, in this world, are beaches in which you can't count the number of granules of sand. And similarly, you can't count the number of granules of transcendental wisdom that are within the Bhagavad Gita. One verse can sustain you throughout your whole life. And this is what we're distributing. And this is what we're taking in the Bhagavad Gita. And this is actually what everyone is looking for. Everybody wants immortality. Everybody wants imperishability. Everybody wants to have happiness. And everybody wants eternality. So it's available, and one has to know the science. And this is the primer. The Bhagavad Gita gives the short versions, just 700 verses in perfect sequence and perfectly described how anyone can attain these qualities and revive one's happy life. So these are the real keys to happiness, and most people in Silicon Valley have no awareness of this. They have fragmental knowledge at best about how to attain happiness. There may be wisdom nuggets that come even from Bhagavad Gita and other places, but the complete science is important for people to imbibe, to be able to read the whole Bhagavad Gita, to be able to hear how to apply it in their lives, and that's the panacea for all of Silicon Valley. So this is the most important mission in Silicon Valley. Other missions are going on to create faster chips. What other kinds of things are going on here? Faster chips, or are they, have they already gone as fast as they can go? Can they go faster? And what else? What else do you get? GPU, yeah. Deep learning? Making machines learn, yeah. Now they're making robots and machines, and they're saying they're making the machines, but what are they going to say? They're going to say the same stuff that you hear from other people who don't know what's going on either. It's like, ask the machine. It's like, who programmed them? The same people who don't have knowledge. It won't ultimately help. What other kind of things are they developing here? Cars that drive themselves. And again, Prabhupada saw through this even in the 1970s. He said, look it, the car's going on four wheels, the dog's going on four legs. He said, if the purpose is the same, there's no difference. It doesn't really matter how fast you go if you're going in the wrong direction. It doesn't help. What else? Internet what? Internet of things, IoT. Everything can talk. And you can get things from any part of the world as quickly as you wish now. But although these are astoundingly amazing feats that people are performing technologically, because the foundation is not understood and the very purpose behind it is not understood, therefore it's simply anxiety producing. In fact, people become saturated because how much more can you put into a smartphone? I mean, how much smarter can it get to make people happy? When it first came out, everyone thought, this is amazing. And now, whenever it comes out, another smartphone, everyone say, is that it? You mean I can only just talk to people all over the world and see their face and take it for granted, become saturated? But when one connects to the spiritual energy internally, one never becomes satiated. There's never a point where we say, oh, that's not good enough. And that's in the very verse we read earlier. One thinks there's no greater gain. Even in the very preliminary stage of advancement in the spiritual science, one has this overwhelming experience that there's nothing better than this, and it doesn't diminish with time. So, we are in a very advantageous situation. Somehow or other, we've found the Bhagavad Gita, either by birth, and then maybe you're interested in it, it's been revived through association and so forth, and we have access to it. Not only that, we have access to a lot of Bhagavad Gitas. In fact, we're making them. That's what we do. This is our business. We produce Bhagavad Gitas, and we distribute them as fast as we can to as many people as we can. Just on the Black Friday, we distributed downtown San Francisco within a few hours 1,200 Bhagavad Gitas to people walking around. And from today, which is December 10th, until January 7th, we're going to distribute 20,000 more Bhagavad Gitas. How much is that in physical size? Like, how many in a case? There's a hunt. How many in a case? 24 in a case of the paperback and 16 in a case of the hardback. So, do we have any? So, what would it look like in this room if we stacked up 20,000 Bhagavad Gitas? How much of the room would it take up? Do you think? All of it, Vrindavan? The whole room? I mean, how many books are there? 47 each side. What are you, omniscient? It's like a savant. 47 each side. I want you to imagine what it looks like. It's a huge operation. The printing of the books, it takes, internally, it takes a lot of consideration. People take months. They have meetings, conference calls, all kinds of ways to find out how to just make the book. Then they have to find the printer. Then they have to deal with the printer. Then they have to ship the books. They come in huge air containers or on the sea, and they get delivered, then they get on trucks, and then they come here, then they end up in the front of the temple, then they end up in the book room. All this takes devotee power, people moving books around the world. So this is a big operation, 20,000 books just in Silicon Valley. So you're all part of this. This is the part of it. And everybody, whatever part you take, you get credit for being in on this this enterprise for inundating Silicon Valley with Bhagavad Gita. Now I'll take a few reflections. That means anything that you've heard so far that's stuck in your mind. Yes. We have two mics or three?
We have four.
Four. Okay, great.
The way in which you explained how all relationships will be taken away and how Prabhupada said that it's only a list of names, and how the relationship that we have with Krishna is a permanent relationship. It really helped me to realize that what to take, what to put our full efforts in, which relationship, and then everything else will be automatically fixed. So that helped me, brought me to my senses. It's a very important point.
Perfect meditation. Think about developing one's relationship with Krishna. Thank you. Yes. And that can be done by bhakti, the practice of bhakti yoga. It's a simple process. Yes.
Thank you, Prabhuji. This remembered the four points that you told about happiness. Like many years ago, when I was hearing some of the lectures, it was said that some problem is a problem for one person, but it is it's something good for some other person. So the real problems are birth, age, old age, disease, and death. And these four points today that you told seem to be the solution to those four problems, which was eternality, immortality, imperishability, and Krishna being the source of all happiness. Thank you.
Those words, when they roll off your tongue, they sound so appealing. But there's a way in which I may hesitate to even entertain them, because I've been beat down so many times in the material world that the tendency, as Krishna says, vitaraga bhaya krodha. He says everyone in the material world has a psychological defect. When they hear about eternality, imperishability, ultimate happiness, and immortality, they think, not possible for me. Krishna says in the Gita, get over it. It's possible for you. Vitaragabha said, give that up. Drop that psychological defect and realize this is possible for you. That's who you are. That's your birthright. And it's altogether possible for human beings. You can be happy that you've made it to this point where you can actually fully take in all this knowledge and attain these qualities that we're talking about. What else? Yes.
Hare Krishna.
By
nice.
The way, that's my poor Bihari. I was talking about him earlier. See, when you distribute Bhagavad Gita, you become famous. Everywhere in the world, people talk about Motil Gita, Motil Gita. I say, listen, it's Mayapur Bihari. And delete by. They conspired to do this, and now it's all over the world. They'll be famous, not just in this life, but for generations, everyone's going to know. They want to know who did this. Who started this? They'll say, these pioneers started this. So if you want real fame, lasting fame, this is the way to do it. Get involved with distributing Bhagavad Gita. Right, Mayapur? Say yes.
Yes.
Thank you.
It is my privilege to see how you encourage and, to think big. And we are just an instrument. I'm talking for Dilip Bhai and myself. It's, we are connecting to the source which comes through you, and it's our privilege to be here and, you know, do this under your grace, mercy and guidance. Thank you.
You think of the great entrepreneurs of Silicon Valley, and you can think of Hewlett and Packard starting a little garage. You think of Steve Wozniak and Steve Jobs starting a little garage, and these two tinkering around. It all started. It all started in Rasika Shekhar's garage. And so this is the greatest kind of entrepreneurialism. Finding out how to expand the teachings of Bhagavad Gita. So you can see the appreciation is pouring out. For that, anyone who has that impetus, you will be recognized by Krishna. What else? I know. Okay, go ahead, Mayapur.
So, Prabhu, it's a wonderful class, and I'm personally inspired to read and take Bhagavad Gita more seriously. I remember that line you said, anyone reading less than 20 verses a day. So, this is, you know, my takeaway, to read it more seriously, and that's the sum and substance out of this session. Very nice, very
like
inspiring.
In any diet, you know, dietitians will tell you, you know, you got to have enough protein, you have to have enough B vitamins and so forth. So in your spiritual life, you have to have a balanced diet. So spiritual dietitians will tell you that you have to have at least 20 verses of Bhagavad Gita a day. Otherwise, you'll become spiritually anemic. And people look at you, what's wrong with you? You're not getting enough Bhagavad Gita. I can tell. You take your Bhagavad Gita and then come back and talk to me, you know. And they come back and say, hey, you look much better. What'd you do? It's 20 verses a day at least. Yeah. Thank you, Mayapur, from all of us. Yeah, Shraddha has devotees checking in from the internet. Everyone turn to the camera and say, Hare Krishna!
Hare Krishna!
This is Kishori Priya Mataji from Florida.
Right.
She says, Hare Krishna Maharaj, humble obeisances. Perhaps the person, when he or she goes out into the world may seem meaningless. The billboards that call out to people saying that they have the source to happiness will seem like nonsense. I had a colleague who, after coming in contact with the Hindu philosophy, came back and said that when he saw a billboard saying happiness is a pair of diamond earrings, then he saw how absurd it was.
Yes. So one should see the world through the eyes of the Bhagavad Gita. And then one will see it for what it is. And this is very much parallel with what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita 6th chapter. He says, when one comes to this vision of seeing what's actually valuable, then he sees pebbles, stones, and gold as the same thing. He's not enamored of the so-called valuable things of this world that you can't keep anyway. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, when he went out with his associates, told them that just see how Krishna has filled up the universe with food and money, but each individual living entity can only get what is apportioned to that, to them. Can't get any more. You can try, but you can't get any more. So devotees realize the futility of trying to make a permanent settlement in this world, and they find the foundation in the Bhagavad Gita. What else? Yes, Bali Mardan Prabhu.
Hare Krishna. I think I like the one, the happiness. Krishna is the ultimate happiness. And I was going through one of the beautiful chapter of Krishna kidnapping Rukmini. And Rukmini was in great anxiety. And at the time, Prabhupada, given the purport, he mentions that how Rukmini was in great anxiety and she saw Krishna, and that transformed complete happiness. And say, Krishna is the real ultimate happiness for everyone, including Rukmini.
Thank you very much. Yes, Prabhu. Oh, yes.
My aspiration was that as people get Bhagavad Gita's all over the Bay Area, that they start offering their food, because there's a couple of verses in the Gita that talk about the sin that you incur from unoffered food, and how he's pleased with the Patram Pushpam, and also how to regulate the sleeping, because if you, there's a picture there, if you sleep too much, then you become a bear in your next life.
Hare Krishna. In our office, there was a discussion on New York Times article that how Silicon Valley is getting in touch with its souls. So it was whole discussion about means how Silicon Valley are all advancement, but they are missing the message of Bhagavad Gita.
They're missing the message of Bhagavad Gita. So we'll try to help out a little.
So
and you can see, yes.
Yeah, so our campaign is with the trend, what Silicon Valley is looking for.
Yeah, we're trendsetters here. And the Krishna consciousness is on the cutting edge, because the other kinds of impetus and so-called progress that others are making, when they're not connected to the idea of us being engaged in devotional service to the Supreme Personality of Godhead, they become sources of anxiety. So everything should be connected to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And in that way, all technology becomes valuable. Prabhupada used to give the example of zeros. And if you have a row of zeros, it's all zero. But if you put a one in front of all the zeros, then it becomes very valuable. So if you have a great and amazing creations, like the ones that are coming about here in Silicon Valley, and then you put Krishna in front of it, then you have something extremely valuable for the world. So we're not Luddites. We do not reject technology or anything else in this world, for that matter. The main point is yoga. Yoga means plus. Yoga means to add Krishna. And if you add Krishna, then everything becomes valuable. And when you take Krishna away, then it becomes zero again. So there's a lifetime of discussion just within this Bhagavad Gita, and that's the purpose of ISKCON Silicon Valley, and our goal starting today, December 10th, 2017, amidst all of the struggles that are going on in the world, is to do our part to distribute from today forward 20,000 Bhagavad Gitas in Silicon Valley in the next couple of weeks. What do you think? Possible?
Yes.
I think so. I think it's possible. I think what we've done over the last couple of decades here is develop an organization, a machine, if you will, that can actually put out 20,000 Bhagavad Gitas in 2 weeks. If we can do 1,200 Bhagavad Gitas in a couple of hours, in 2 weeks, we can definitely do 20,000 Bhagavad Gitas. What do you think?
Yes.
Say yes.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Gopremanande Nitai Gaur Hari Bol Hari Bol Nitai Gaur Hari Bol
Hari Bol Hari Bol Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, hey, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman, Natari Armarman.